It's Friday, March 8, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The state of Arkansas now becomes ground zero in America's battle over abortion. This could be traced back to this very week when on Wednesday, the Arkansas legislature passed into law a measure that will become the most direct challenge to Roe v. Wade since the abortion decision was handed down in 1973. Eric Eckholm of the New York Times reports, quote, Arkansas adopted what is by far the country's most restrictive ban on abortion on Wednesday. At 12 weeks of pregnancy, when a fetal heartbeat can typically be detected by abdominal ultrasound. The law, Eckholm writes, the sharpest challenge yet to Roe v. Wade, was passed by the newly Republican-controlled legislature over the veto of Governor Mike Beebe, a Democrat, who called it blatantly unconstitutional. The state Senate voted Tuesday to override his veto, and the House followed suit on Wednesday with several Democrats joining the Republican majority, end quote. What we're looking at here is indeed a head-on collision with Roe v. Wade. That infamous 1973 U.S. Supreme Court decision effectively legalized abortion on demand throughout the United States. The situation in Arkansas is a vivid reminder of just how the landscape on abortion has changed, first going back to the legalization of abortion in 1973, and today's reality that many states are doing their dead-level best to curtail abortion, or, as in the case of Arkansas this week, to present Roe v. Wade with a head-on test. Eckholm, writing for the New York Times, makes very clear that the adoption of the law known as the Human Heartbeat Protection Act signals what could be a very important and strategic change in tactics for the pro-life movement. Over the course of the last decade or more, the pro-life strategy has been to attempt incremental curtailments of abortion, restrictions placed on abortion clinics, the requirement that parental notification be given for abortions in the case of minors, and other regulations that have effectively stood the test of time and constitutional muster and have, at the very least, curtailed the number of abortions performed in at least some jurisdictions. But the new effort is very different. What the Arkansas legislature has now set up is a direct challenge to the constitutionality of Roe v. Wade. Eric Eckholm, as he reports the story, gets it exactly right. Virtually everyone that has anything to do with this particular act now enacted over the veto of Arkansas's governor by the legislature is absolutely running counter not only to Roe v. Wade, but to the successive U.S. Supreme Court decisions that have basically sustained it. But there is something very important going on here. What we're looking at is a head-on challenge to Roe v. Wade and a sense of confidence on the part of the Republican-controlled legislature in Arkansas that the time is right to shift from an incrementalist methodology to a direct confrontation. What seems to be the calculation of the folks in Arkansas is that they have the better arguments, that the pro-life cause, indeed, is winning converts by the very force and power of its logic. If this is true or not, time will tell. But at this point, it is exceedingly interesting that the Arkansas legislature is pushing ahead with this, not believing that it is simply engaged in legislative futility, but actually doing something that could lead to the saving of untold numbers of unborn American children. Arkansas, by the way, has only one functioning abortion clinic that is actually conducting surgical abortions. And that truth points to what might be the most important take-home lesson from this particular issue. That is the fact that when you're talking about a country as large and diverse as the United States of America, when you talk about a nation's position or a nation's conscience on an issue as controversial as this, one should be very careful to make certain that regional differences are taken into account. Remember, the news story says that there is only one abortion clinic in Arkansas conducting surgical abortions. Compare that with Manhattan, where in some Manhattan neighborhoods, and now increasingly it will be true of the city of New York as a whole, the number of abortions exceeds the number of live births. In other words, America may be one nation from sea to shining sea, but when it comes to its moral convictions, regionalism still matters, and matters intensely. Americans sometimes falsely remember that the situation prior to the handing down of Roe v. Wade meant that abortion was illegal in all 50 states. But that was not the case. Even in 1973, before the handing down of Roe v. Wade, a significant number of American states had legalized abortion. Most of them were in the Northeast in terms of America's more liberal Atlantic corridor, and some were also in the Northwest. But the reality is that regional differences, getting down to the issue of morality and worldview, have been a part of the American experiment from the very beginning. Our experiment in constitutional federalism was made possible by the recognition that different states had very different outlooks even on the question of what kind of nation the United States should be, and of course the more pressing question of just how powerful its central government should be. Remember also that this act was passed into law by action of the Arkansas legislature. Arkansas's governor had vetoed the laws. But over the course of just the last few days, the Arkansas Senate and then the Arkansas House overrode the governor's veto. That should tell you something of the depth of pro-life sentiment in the state of Arkansas. Similarly, in contrast, if you were to look at the state of New York or perhaps New Jersey or even Maryland, you would discover that pro-abortion and pro-choice legislators vastly outnumber those who are pro-life. Region still matters. Geography still matters. Local culture still matters. Looking at the issue of abortion in America, it is exceedingly clear that we have a nationwide policy on abortion simply because it was forced on the nation by the U.S. Supreme Court back in 1973. Many people, including at least some who are advocates of the pro-abortion position, believe that the court harmed its own prestige and standing by that particular intervention. But what we're looking at here is also an affirmation of the fact that the parts of the country that are most steadfastly pro-abortion are also those that are more pervasively secularized. In other words, looking at Arkansas, connected to the American Bible Belt, one gains the recognition that in many parts of the country, the Deep South and Sun Belt especially, issues like abortion would be settled in a very conservative way, if settled locally. Likewise, the two coasts, especially the Northwest and the American Upper Atlantic coast, would almost certainly feature state-by-state competitions to see which state could be more liberal and more progressive, by its own definition, in terms of abortion legislation and policies. Without any surprise whatsoever, several liberal voices within the state of Arkansas began to bemoan the embarrassment that had befallen their state simply because this act, this piece of pro-life legislation, had been adopted. Eric Eckholm quotes Rita Sklar, director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Arkansas, who said, and I quote, "It sets Arkansas back several decades in the eyes of the nation and of the world. It shows an utter disregard for women and their ability to make important personal decisions about their own reproductive health," end quote. That statement reveals the very callous heartlessness at the heart of the pro-abortion movement. What we're looking at here is a declaration that the only issue at stake, the only issue of important moral force, is the question of a woman's, quote, "ability to make important personal decisions about their own reproductive health," end quote. Consider for a moment just how telling that statement is. It includes absolutely no recognition whatsoever of the moral significance of the child that is missing altogether from the picture. All that remains is a woman's right to choose and exercise what is described here as a set of personal decisions over her exclusively private life. It will be extremely interesting to see what happens with this case in Arkansas, this new law that is almost assuredly going to be challenged immediately in the federal courts. The precedents in the federal courts are not unilaterally pointing in one direction or the other. As Eric Eckholm reports, approximately 20 states in the Union have been able to use legislation in order to minimize abortions after 20 weeks. The Arkansas measure stipulates 12 weeks. It will indeed be very interesting to see what happens to this law in Arkansas and what happens as the Supreme Court is almost assuredly watching with a wary eye as challenges to this law will make their way up through the federal system. Shifting to the issue of same-sex marriage, writing in the Financial Times, columnist Michael Scapinger, who writes the Business and Society column in that newspaper, suggests, in his words, companies must gauge the speed of social shifts, end quote. A social shift is exactly what we are experiencing now. We've often drawn reference to the massive social, cultural, and moral changes taking place around us, changes that are so significant that they do not represent a mere modification of a moral worldview, but rather the revolutionary restructuring altogether of what had been a received morality into something else. On the issue of homosexuality, for instance, we're talking about nothing less than an almost total moral reversal, all this in the span of about one long generation. What Michael Skapinker writes about is what he calls the responsibility of corporations to get with the program. He writes with dripping condescension of those who have been recognized in later historical times to have been on the wrong side of a moral contest. He then writes this: "I suspect a century and a half from now, people will take the same view of the gay marriage debate, finding the fuss quaint and the opponents archaic. The arguments against are thin even now. One is that religion doesn't allow it, inviting the retort that one segment of society's theological beliefs should not be imposed on everyone else." He goes on to write a very telling paragraph. He writes, quote, "The other argument, that gay unions undermine heterosexual marriage, is not so much wrong as incomprehensible. Many things undermine marriage: selfishness, boredom, resentment, financial strains. But would anyone really abandon a spouse because gays were getting married?" End quote. That particular paragraph is not merely condescending, it is absolutely evasive in moral terms. He just dismisses out of hand any claim that the legalization of same-sex marriage would redefine marriage. But he goes on, basically, later in his article, to accept what he here rejects, and that is the fact that such a massive moral change is indeed extremely significant. The issue here is, of course, that he thinks it's good news. And again, he says that it is the responsibility of corporations and businesses to get with the program and to join the momentum towards what he describes as the inevitability of the legalization of same-sex marriage. This is exactly the kind of argument we should expect to see writ large across our society, increasingly so in months and years ahead. There will be those who will very openly try to make the suggestion that there simply is no legitimate, responsible argument against same-sex marriage. The argument will be continued to assert that those who have opposed same-sex marriage are holding to dangerous, intolerant, and anti-modern worldviews, and, furthermore, that they simply deserve to be marginalized. That is basically the essential thrust of this article. Of course, on the other hand, this article is written towards business people, urging them to go ahead and endorse same-sex marriage, or at the very least, not to oppose it publicly. Here again, we see an argument that is likely to be more and more common in years ahead. The argument would run something like this: since society is undergoing this major moral shift, and since the direction of it is so clear, stockholders and stakeholders in major corporations have every right to expect that the CEOs, the chief executive officers they hire, will be responsible to those directions in the culture in order to preserve and perhaps even to enhance the market posture, influence, and business magnitude of the corporation at stake. Ending his article with what he apparently believes is an absolute clincher argument, he then writes this: "There is a tide in the affairs of men," Shakespeare said, "which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune." He could have added that if the tide fails to carry you, you end up stranded and looking silly, end quote. So this columnist for the Financial Times, Michael Skapinker, writes that those who oppose same-sex marriage should brace themselves in fairly short order not only to be marginalized in the larger society, but at the end of the day, to be found to be nothing more than simply silly. No one, we should note, wants to be considered silly, certainly considered silly by peers and by the larger culture. But perhaps it's time that we kept very much in mind that Christians throughout the centuries have been called much, much worse than this. Finally for this week, writing in the Wall Street Journal, Peter Funt argues that perhaps we as a society have gone too far in the embrace of the ephemeral. Funt is identified as a writer and public speaker. He writes at CandidCamera.com, and he writes about the development of new apps, new applications, and features on the World Wide Web. He writes this: "With the mobile app known as Snapchat, users now exchange more than 60 million photographs each day. The primary appeal for the service's avid fans, who tend to be in their late teens, is that the images are never saved. The goofy poses, the silly jokes, even the loving glances, they all vanish within seconds. Life, at least as glimpsed through Snapchat, is entirely disposable, end quote. Peter Funk goes on to make very clear that Snapchat is not now alone on the web. Facebook quickly came up with a similar service called Poke. Funt then writes, one of Snapchat's slogans is, there is value in the ephemeral. Roughly translated, he says, there is no point in taking good photos or worrying about your appearance or fretting over bad behavior because it's all going to disappear quickly, only to be replaced by the next batch of evanescence. Life is a blur and leaves no traces, end quote. Peter Funt raises a very important issue here related not only to these new apps and features, but also to the web itself. The web is often blamed for maintaining everything, cached forever, available somewhere in the cloud or on a disk. But the reality is, as Funt makes clear, that there is so much material, such an avalanche of material on the World Wide Web, that it is very easy for any particular portion of it to be lost and seemingly lost forever. He wonders aloud if this is actually good for the society. He writes, quote, the great contradiction in the digital age is that while material is said to last indefinitely, its intangible quality might actually make it less permanent in our lives. When letters were written by hand, for example, some were saved and treasured. He then asks, is there much chance that anyone's emails will be preserved for posterity? End quote. That is indeed one of the great quandaries of the modern age, as is represented in our digital lives. We have so much put out there on the web. We have such a massive abundance of information available out there in the cloud and virtually everywhere in the World Wide Web. And yet, when it comes to some of the things that should be most precious to us, these issues become so ephemeral that they are not even written down. They never find their way onto paper, certainly not by the action of a hand moving with ink on that paper. Instead, they simply disappear. Snapchat is just a parable of our times, made very convenient for the majority users of the site, teenagers, who want to show something for a moment, but then leave no trace of themselves that could get them in trouble. This is a generation that wants to be instantly exposed to their peers and then to have the exposure disappear so that that nosy college admissions counselor can't find the same photograph. Peter Funt is almost assuredly correct that, as a society, we are leaning far too much in the direction of the ephemeral, leaving far too little for generations yet to come. On the other hand, it's probably unfair to point to America's adolescents as the cause of the problem. In this case, they represent the rest of us, for as a society, we are just as they are. We want to be exposed, but we want to limit the exposure. We want all the benefits of the web, and yet we seem to convince ourselves that there are no accompanying dangers. We spend perhaps even hours a day dealing with email, not admitting to ourselves that in just a short amount of time, no one is even going to care. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Los Angeles, California, and I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.